Thank you. Okay, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling 824-0307, Christopher Villela versus Patrick Villela et al.
Okay. And counsel, as you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. If you have your program set to your gallery mode, do you both see that?
I do, Judge. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Again, we just ask counsel to introduce themselves and their counsel at the beginning of each argument so that our recording, excuse me, is clear. We have an audio recording that will be available on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours. And also, just since we're on the Zoom format, please remember to mute yourself but leave your video on when problems with the technology at any point, please let me know and we'll pause and we'll make sure that that's fixed because we want to ensure that we hear from everyone here today. So with that, counsel for appellant, there are 15 minutes on the clock and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Peter Frank. I'm here representing the appellant, Christopher Villela. Your Honors, this case is about the application of settled law. And that law is that the outcome of a summary eviction action does not control the outcome of a related civil action for title or for unjust enrichment. And I want to start by sort of closing the loop on a legal issue that I was reviewing my brief. I just want to be clear. I think the central error that the district court made was not applying the Rucker versus Schmidt test, and specifically the full and fair opportunity to litigate prong of that test. And the interplay of that with the Amresco case and the other cases that talk about the scope of an eviction action. My client did not have a full and fair opportunity to litigate title issues and unjust enrichment issues in the eviction court, as a matter of fact. But more critically, it's impossible for him to have a full and fair opportunity to litigate because the Amresco case tells us that you can't bring a counterclaim for title. You can't bring other counterclaims that you could bring in a civil action. And so not only did he not get a full and fair opportunity to litigate, but it was impossible under this court's case law for those issues to be litigated in the eviction court. And so with that, Your Honor, I'll get into some of the facts here. In 2020, my client buys a property on a contract for deed. The intention is, and he does move on to that property in a manufactured home.
Counsel, forgive me for stopping you. We are familiar with the facts. I do want to go to the unjust enrichment claim, however, because while you cited case law that says that you can't litigate unjust enrichment or quiet title claims in an eviction action, this one seemed to be a little unique in the sense that while eviction generally addresses the present possessory right, in order to make that decision, the district court had to make findings of fact regarding who had title.
What I would say to that, Your Honor, is I don't think that the district court made any finding about who had title. And to the extent that it did, it was going beyond its authority in an eviction proceeding. And the other point, and I'll get to this in more detail later, is that even if the court disagrees with my primary argument and says that there is some sort of preclusive effect from the eviction proceeding, there were still unresolved issues of material fact related to title and related to unjust enrichment that were never addressed by the eviction court. And especially in the context of unjust enrichment, Your Honors, the district court actually said, or excuse me, the eviction court actually said in its memorandum, and this is in your addendum at page, in my addendum at page 19, that that it was not deciding any issues related to unjust enrichment and that there could be a future proceeding about unjust enrichment.
Mr. Frank.
Right, right. And I agree with you. And I speaking only for myself, I agree with you on that in terms of what the eviction court's order said. But the eviction court did say that, did make a finding that the deed had been properly canceled. That seems to be a finding that future courts need to follow, correct?
I disagree, Your Honor. Under the law, the eviction court decides present possession. And so in my view, what an eviction court should be doing in situations like this is looking at, was the procedure followed correctly in terms of, was the notice served, had the 60 days run, has cure been made, and has there been a recording of the cancellation? And as for underlying issues as to whether there was a proper default, whether there are other issues related to title, whether there could be a, let's say, a constructive trust related to an unjust enrichment claim, none of those title issues are within the scope of what the eviction court can actually decide. And what I think the eviction court actually decided here was present possession. That's what the court said it was deciding. That's even what the district court here said the eviction court decided. And so it could say based on the record before it, it didn't see that there was any flaws with the procedure used in the cancellation. But that doesn't foreclose the possibility of title issues being raised in a subsequent proceeding.
But inherent in that decision, the court had to consider the contract for deed and whether it was valid and whether, all of those things that you're saying are rolled into the decision that it made. I don't know how we can parse them apart.
Sure, Your Honor. I'd say, number one, I'd say, first of all, the extent the district court, the eviction court made those decisions was beyond the scope of what it was allowed to do, and the court should not view those as binding. But assuming for the sake of argument, I understand the question, assuming for the sake of argument, that there's preclusive effects from the eviction court's ruling, was summary judgment proper here? And the answer is no. And why is that? Because there's a whole bunch of factual and legal issues that are still present in this case that the eviction court did not address in any way. For example, the eviction court never addressed the issue of which party was responsible for addressing the notice from the county. The contract, to me, as I read it, says that that's the responsibility of the respondents because the contract says that the appellant doesn't have the right to make changes to the property and because the respondents have the obligation to address any regulatory or legal issues with the property that existed at the time it was sold. Those issues not addressed by the eviction court. The eviction court never addressed the fact that there were inaccurate disclosures at the time of the contract for deed signing. If there were factual errors in those disclosures, that's an issue with the validity of the contract for deed and the interpretation of its terms that were never addressed by the eviction court. As we've discussed, the eviction court definitely never addressed any issues with unjust enrichment. You'll never see anything in that eviction court order about the down payment my client made, about his monthly payments over time, and about whether the respondents were unjustly enriched by those payments if they canceled the contract without justification later. The
eviction Wouldn't court, just an enrichment claim need to rely on any improvements that were made to the real property?
That certainly would be a factor in an unjust enrichment claim, Your Honor. And I'd say that goes to another error in this case, which is the fact that we've had now two proceedings in eviction court and in district court where we've had no discovery and no opportunity to look into the facts on what the condition of the property was and how the property was improved over time.
But looking at the standard of review here, where is there any allegation in the complaint as to what improvements were made to the real property?
Well, Your Honor, I can certainly say that I think the complaint needs to be clarified. I understand the point that, that's my client unrepresented. It's his responsibility to plead things properly, but we are in a situation here where I think it makes sense that the district, obviously, regardless of what this court decides, there's still issues pending before the district court. This was a partial appeal. We're going to go back one way or the other. There are going to be claims for the district court to decide. it makes sense, given the state of the complaint, that there should be an opportunity to amend so we can clarify the issues that actually need to be litigated. And just to follow up on my last point, the other thing that I think is critical that the eviction court never addressed was that there was a payment by my client made during the 60-day period, and that was accepted by the respondents. Now, we have a whole plethora of case law, including Cotton versus Young France, that says if you accept a payment from the party that's being canceled out, that's inconsistent with the intent to cancel because you're accepting a payment under the contract. That's an issue as to the validity of the cancellation that the eviction court never addressed, never decided, and needs to be litigated in the district court proceeding. So I'll take the court's point about that you've read the facts and understand them. I'll move on. I want to talk about the record on summary judgment. And I think it's critical, Your Honors, in order for you to affirm here, you'd have to find that there was a sufficient prima facie case for summary judgment, and it's just not there. The only facts in the record on summary judgment are in Mr. Borland's affidavit. It's index number 17 in the record. No other testimony, no other facts, no other documents in support of summary judgment. There's three documents attached to this affidavit: the contract for deed, the notice of cancellation, and the eviction court order. And so, Your Honors, with that impoverished record, the only way you could grant summary judgment is if you conclude that the eviction court controls the outcome of any subsequent action for title or unjust enrichment. Not even the evidence, you know, that came in to the eviction court, that was not presented to the district court. The only thing the district court had to base its decision on was the order itself from the eviction court. And that's just not enough, unless you conclude that the result, an eviction judgment, means that all types of civil claims are foreclosed and cannot proceed because the party was evicted because the court concluded that one party had a superior right to present possession. That's just not how it works. That's not what the case law says. It's an error. Frazier tells us it's an error. Amresco tells us that's an error. But if that case law doesn't persuade the court, I think there's a really compelling example from this court in a decision that was issued on Monday of this week. It was Juan Cuate versus Pedro Cuate. That's spelled C-U-A-T-E. The court file number is A23-1951. And I specifically direct the court to footnote 6 of that case. It's a case, it was an appeal of an eviction, published decision by this court. The court affirmed the eviction. And in affirming, it said in a footnote, we nevertheless note that according to their brief, appellants have reportedly commenced a separate action in the district court to determine their rights to the property under constructive trust. We express no opinion about the validity of appellant's oral agreement to buy the residence for purposes of their constructive trust action. And nothing in this opinion should be construed as deciding any of the party's rights to the property beyond the eviction that is currently before us. And then the court cited Amresco in support of that statement. Your Honors, I think that says it all. It's black letter law. The eviction does not, should not, even an appeal of an eviction does not control the party's rights in a subsequent civil action for title, for unjust enrichment. This is a reference to a constructive trust. Constructive trust is generally a remedy for unjust enrichment. I think that would potentially apply in this case as well. And so we have a binding decision here affirming and, you know, reaffirming what this court said many times in Frazier and Amresco. It just doesn't control.
Counsel, I'm familiar with that case, and I'm looking at the footnote, and I'm not sure it really stands for the proposition for which you were citing. I think that that footnote is just saying that the opinion is limited in its decision, and it's not expressing an opinion on the merits of that particular issue.
Okay, I understood, Your Honor. I read it differently, but I guess I direct the court back to Amresco, which is cited there in that, you know, again, looking at Rucker, looking at full and fair opportunity to litigate, if you can't bring a counterclaim for title, and if you can't bring a counterclaim for unjust enrichment, how could you possibly have a full and fair opportunity to litigate? You can't. It's impossible. And I'll say, as a practical matter, you know, I litigate eviction cases. I litigate title cases. Title is a very complicated animal, and litigating it is not something that you can do in a 2-week time frame with no discovery, with no depositions, with no opportunity to do title searches and research and investigation. The case law, not only is it the case law that evictions shouldn't control future subsequent civil actions for title, it's practically just correct. You can't do that. It's not fair to the litigants. It's not a...
Mr. Frank, I think what I'd like you to address, and possibly when we come back, is, you know, whether you've made your arguments about res judicata, whether collateral estoppel applies here, just on that specific issue of the validity of the contract for deed, because it seems to me that inherent in the decision for present possessory interest, there had to be a determination about that aspect. And so doesn't that piece at least come forward in all of these subsequent hearings? I understand what you're saying about the fact that you cannot litigate these other claims in an eviction proceeding. However, you are bound by the portion that's relevant in terms of issue preclusion. And that's where I'd like you to address that, at least, because the it seems to me, and I also may be, it would be helpful to indicate that on the question of summary judgment for the unjust enrichment claim and the quiet title claim, it doesn't seem that there was enough pled in the complaint in order to sustain those, in particular, the adverse possession theory, which we know requires many, many years, 15 years of possession. And I don't think there's anything in the record that would support that your client was possessed of the property earlier than 2020. So perhaps those are things that we could talk about on your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just real briefly, I'm not arguing that a adverse possession claim is, we're not pursuing that claim at this point. We are pursuing a claim to title, and that would be based on constructive trust unjust enrichment theory.
Okay. Thank you for that. And we'll have 15 minutes on the clock, and we'll turn to Mr. Borland to present for respondents. If you're not speaking, be sure to mute. And please, Mr. Borland, remember to introduce yourself and your clients. You may begin when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Andy Borland. I am the attorney for the respondents, Patrick and Beth Villella. Patrick is actually in the room with me here. He's just off camera. By the questions you asked, counsel, you clearly are familiar with the facts. From our perspective as the respondents, we think the issues before the court are relatively straightforward. And by the questions you asked counsel, we're in the same position as some of your questions. As in, for the eviction court to grant my clients any right to possess the property that's subject to the contract for deed, the court would have to make a determination that that contract had actually been canceled. Otherwise, there is no way the respondents would have any possessory right to the property at all. For counsel's argument, out of an eviction proceeding, you could never have an eviction proceeding out of a cancellation of a contract for deed, because his argument essentially is, well, no, that doesn't, all that decides is possessory right. But I think it's pretty clear by the law, my clients are the contract for deed vendors. They have no right to the actual possession of the property unless that contract was canceled. So I think that was probably before the eviction court. Otherwise, an eviction court could never take up a proceeding under a statutory cancellation of a contract for deed. So I think it's probably before the court. The court had, as the court is, you are aware by the addendum, The court had a detailed trial with respect to those particular issues. The appellant offered testimony on his behalf. There were exhibits offered on behalf of my clients. There was testimony from third parties. The court then made detailed findings and conclusions with respect to that decision. And as the court has already questioned counsel on, this is a little bit different than many of the proceedings that counsel is relying on that say, this is simply a summary proceeding. You can't rely on that going forward. It was the only proceeding going on at the time as the eviction judge specifically noted. No other cases had been commenced at the time that she heard the eviction proceeding. Thus, it was the only way to determine who had the possessory right. So from respondent's perspective, the trial court had every right to take the eviction proceeding and its findings and conclusions and apply those to the action that appellant then subsequently served and filed, under which the summary judgment motion was brought.
Counsel, I understand your position that the eviction court did not have any quiet title action or decision to which it could defer before making the possessory interest determination. But isn't that putting the cart a little bit before the horse? Shouldn't the eviction court have basically, you know, said, I can't determine possessory interest until the issue of title is determined first? And an eviction court is not the proper venue to determine title.
So, Your Honor, is taking your fact pattern then, after a statutory cancellation of a contract for deed, the vendor would then commence a district court action after already canceling the contract to essentially litigate that entire issue over again to come to a determination that they, in fact, are entitled with regard to the property because of the statutory cancellation, and then bring an eviction action.
No, I think my apologies. I may not have been as clear.
I probably didn't track right, sorry.
No, no worries at all. My point is the eviction court here made a finding of fact with respect to the title in terms of who owns title. And then based on that finding, made a determination in terms of who actually possesses the property. But here's my question. Aren't eviction courts really limited to just making a determination on possession and not making any finding or determination as to who owns title? And by making that title finding and determination, did the eviction court exceed its authority?
I think I understand your question, Judge. And if I state this wrong, correct me. So you're distinguishing the cancellation of the contract for deed in your question to say, even if my clients canceled that contract, they in fact may not have title to the real estate and therefore wouldn't have a possessory right to obtain it or to advocate that they're the owners of it going forward, if I heard you correctly.
I guess that's one way of looking at it. I mean, could the district court have assumed without deciding the title issue so it could decide definitively that the only issue an eviction court should be decided in terms of possession?
Judge, I would defer to you. So maybe the respondent was making a leap of faith to say, well, because we own the property beforehand and we literally have a contract for deed, we don't have anything else with the contract for deed vendee, in this case, the appellant. That, in fact, when we cancel the contract, any title with respect to the property reverts back to us. We don't have any other action pending at the time, nor did we get an action alleging, as counsel now says, unjust enrichment vis-a-vis a constructive trust, therefore have some claim to the property. So I think the eviction court was within its rights, Judge, in this particular case, to determine who had the present possessory right by the nature of the statutory cancellation. If that answers your question any better, but thank you.
Mr. Borland, I'm not sure if you would agree, but opposing counsel has pointed out that there are facts that are still in dispute, including who is responsible between these parties for fixing the septic system and what happened with cure, what attempts for cure were made. My question to you is the determination of those facts actually relevant to the quiet title or the unjust enrichment claims, or are they irrelevant and therefore not a basis for us to find that there's still a genuine issue of material fact here on those two claims?
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge, in my opinion, on behalf of my client, those issues should have been raised as a part of the eviction proceeding because those are direct challenges to the cancellation of the contract for deed, which was done by a statutory proceeding and which the appellant had every right to raise at that particular time in that particular proceeding. So he didn't raise those at the time, other than his testimony to say, I cured the problem, I brought in the document saying that now it's back in non-compliance to my office. I think that was some of his testimony in the eviction proceeding. But he should have raised those then because the statutory cancellation was found by the eviction court to be proper. I think those issues are now resolved. I don't think there's another day because essentially counsel then is saying, we're going to relitigate the statutory cancellation, even though there's already been a finding to say that that was already properly done.
Mr. Borland, might that be relevant, whether it's quiet title, unjust enrichment? And the reason I raise that question is it does seem like if it's true that it should have been raised, but of course he was pro se. And it also seems like, on the other hand, it kind of ties into the limitations of an eviction court, meaning the judge didn't make any findings, of course, related to that. So there's no conclusion. So it would seem not to be an issue that's collaterally estopped as long as it might be relevant to the equitable claims in district court. I'm used to, and maybe that's the difference of the statutory, when I was in district court, often would have cancellations by action. And of course they'd be in district court. What would be the first issue, of course, if the sole basis for cancellation, you would have to interpret the contract and whose obligation was it. And in a case like that, I would raise it if the parties didn't raise it. And so it just seems like a white elephant in the room, should we say, that's never been resolved and yet was critical to the cancellation because it was the sole issue.
Your Honor, I would agree that those issues all, and counsel wants to say, I want to bring these up as a part of an unjust enrichment. Counsel concedes in his briefs that his client brought in money and that our office sent money back to him. So if that was his unjust enrichment claim, he already has that money in his hands. He's just elected not to cash it. Otherwise, the unjust enrichment, I think, frankly, those are somewhat of a ruse to attack the statutory cancellation of the contract for deed. They're really looking for a way to reopen that whole issue and litigate that issue as compared to unjust enrichment being, we have a trailer on a property and we've made a couple of years of payments at $200 a month, I believe is the contract. So and statutory cancellations aren't illegal, they aren't improper, and it's well known that if you fail to make your payments, you forfeit the money you've paid to that point in time. So I do distinguish the two, Judge. I really think that the issues that counsel is raising are a way of reopening up the cancellation that the eviction court already found was done properly. And I don't plan on taking all my time, Your Honors. I would just briefly cite the Amresco case that counsel has referred to in his brief and I reviewed in mine. And I'm not familiar, I'll just be candid, I'm not familiar with the case counsel referred to that came out on Monday. However, the Amresco case in its dicta, citing the Supreme Court, recognized that The matter of eviction proceedings is a little bit antiquated in that at one time those were done by municipal courts. Now they're done by district courts. And to say that, well, we're only limited to this, is that realistic? When in fact, a court can have a trial go as long as it chooses to in the eviction court and present whatever evidence and so forth is relevant, which the appellant had every right and had every reason to do in this particular case and elected not to. I can't control what gets raised. I just know in the eviction that I had a cancellation done. I don't know why I would raise other issues that were aside from that, when in fact my client needed was seeking possessory interest of the property. And the only basis for that was to cancel that contract. Otherwise, there would be no reason to bring the eviction proceeding.
Mr. Borland, in order for a preclusive effect to occur, whether under res judicata or issue preclusion, collateral estoppel, it seems that one of the elements is a full and fair opportunity to litigate the title issue. And I think that's what Mr. Frank started with as well in his presentation, that you can't, he would argue that we can't find that exists here. What is your response to that?
So if in fact the appellant was seeking to have his possessory rights and then protect his interests, he could have raised every one of those in the eviction proceeding. It would have given him a possessory right to make those claims. He elected not to. Keep in mind, Your Honors, when I brought my summary judgment motion, he could have raised anything then as well to say, oh, I have these other rights. And he'd already brought an action claiming unjust enrichment. He elected to file nothing, even after the district court judge essentially said, I don't care if you filed anything before the appellant's or the respondent's motion or not. I'll give you time up until this time to file anything else you might, and I'll take it under consideration. He didn't file anything then. The only time that we've seen anything is from counsel. He filed a motion and so forth after, but only after the summary judgment was filed. So I think the appellant had his opportunity to raise those issues. He elected not to. And the fact that he's pro se should not be a basis under the law. Say, well, that's my reasonable excuse. I didn't know any better. Because he certainly had been in contact with counsel, because even during the eviction proceeding, for a brief time, he had an attorney, and then that attorney withdrew. Your Honor, the other issues before the court beyond that are whether or not the trial court properly addressed the counsel's Rule 6002 claim. In order for that to, and I think could the trial judge had done a better job of writing up the decision? Sure. I didn't write it, obviously. The Judge Patney took it under consideration and wrote it. I think by the nature of the complaint that he had in front of him at the time, and by the nature of how those the allegations raised, there was no substantive prayer for relief in those documents at all. There is the reference you made, Judge, the adverse possession, and there is the reference to the unjust enrichment. But it's that and simply
time is up.
I apologize. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Borland. We will add 5 minutes to the clock and turn back to Mr. Frank for rebuttal. I see that's on there. You may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a couple of things Mr. Borland said. He faults my client for not raising some of these issues during the eviction proceeding. That goes back to, what I started off my presentation with, which is that we have crystal clear case law. You cannot bring a counterclaim for title. You cannot bring a counterclaim for unjust enrichment in the eviction action. Even if my client had wanted to do that, had known that that was an option, actually, even if he'd been learned in the law, he would have known that that's not an option. You can't.
Even if he couldn't bring the claim as a claim per se, couldn't he have made those arguments to support his position that he had a possessory right?
Yeah, I mean, my client certainly could have made a different presentation to the eviction court. I don't think that's really the issue here on this appeal. The issue is whether there was a prima facie case for summary judgment based on the Index 17 and the evidence that was presented to the district court. And I don't think that a eviction court decision about who has the present possessory right to the property can ever control the outcome of who has title. And it can never control the outcome of whether there's a valid unjust enrichment claim. Those need to be decided in civil litigation.
Counsel, I don't think there is a question of whether present possessory interest can control a later decision on title. But I don't think that's the issue here. The issue here is whether or not the finding underlying findings on title from the eviction action have preclusive effect. I want to go back to the question that Judge Wheelock had asked just prior to the conclusion of your initial arguments of whether or not the collateral estoppel doctrine actually applies here and in relation to the findings of fact rather than res judicata.
Thank you for bringing that up again, Your Honor. Here's what I'd say to that. As I said before, you know, if for the sake of argument, the court concludes that there's some kind of preclusive effect, I think it's clear it can't be res judicata. If there's some sort of collateral estoppel effect, then maybe there's a binding result as to particular issues of fact or particular issues of law that the eviction court decided and put it into its order. But as I previously went over, there's a whole bunch of other issues of fact and issues of law that the eviction court did not address, were not litigated in the eviction court, and have not been litigated, and no discovery has been done related to those issues in district court. And so even if there's some preclusive effects here, there needs to be litigation on what exactly is precluded and what claims may survive as a result of that. But the district court's order that it's res judicata, that it's fully barred, and that we don't even analyze those things is an error. And Your Honor, just to wrap.
But didn't your client have the opportunity to address those issues when the issue of title came up with respect to the deed in the eviction proceeding?
No, Your Honor, because Amoresco says that he can't bring a counterclaim for title.
That's not the issue. The issue isn't whether he can bring a counterclaim. The issue is when that issue had been raised.
I think didn't
that provide an opportunity for appellant to address the issue of the deed and the validity of the deed?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because by the same token, I don't think it makes sense to say you can raise title as an affirmative defense, but not as a counterclaim. I think the scope of what an eviction court decides is limited. It's limited to possession. And that title issues are reserved for later litigation if it's brought. And I'm running out of time, so just to wrap up, Your Honors, I think the error here is best summed up by the district court's own words cited in my brief. Plaintiff has already litigated most, if not all, the issues in the eviction proceeding, most, if not all. That's not the standard here. The standard is Rucker versus Schmidt. The district court did not apply it. The decision's erroneous, and it should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Frank. Thank you to both counsel for your argument here today and for the briefing. It's been very helpful, and the matter is submitted, and we will issue a decision in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.